Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity to speak here today. It's my first time at the Philadelphia Society meeting, and I've been delighted with the people that I've met and the discussion that's been going on yesterday and today. As the U.S. presidential election draws closer, this wild presidential election, politicians and voters are considering different ways to reignite a depressed economy and labor market, despite what you hear in the news about yesterday's jobs report, during a historically weak economic recovery. The heart of this is a debate between extractive or progressive institutions that forcefully redistribute resources and inclusive institutions or free market institutions that allow individuals to satisfy their own desires through voluntary transactions. The U.S. was once the envy of the world as it held the Bronze Prize in economic freedom in 2000, not too long ago, according to the Economic Freedom of the World Index published by the Fraser Institute. After years of government intervention in the economy and our daily lives, this ranking has fallen to 16th behind Taiwan, resulting in lackluster economic growth and job creation. This decline precipitated from policies attempting to stabilize the economy through unprecedented fiscal and monetary actions. In fact, the current economic recovery looks to be one of the worst on record, with average annual growth of only 2.1%, with no relief in sight. The direction of public policy must change radically. Federal spending has increased by 27% since the fourth quarter of 2008, when the financial crisis took its greatest toll. The spending included bailing out banks and an almost $1 trillion stimulus package, contributing to an 80% increase in the national debt to $19 trillion. This debt now exceeds all the country's economic output. Though the sequester recently restrained spending, and it has expired, unfortunately, and didn't correct the massive increase beforehand. In December 2008, the Federal Reserve took historic action by lowering the federal funds rate to the range of 0 to 0.25% and multiple rounds of bond buying programs over the years called quantitative easing. These actions were primarily intended to keep interest rates low to stimulate the economy. A common benchmark for the direction of the federal funds rate is the Taylor Rule, named after Stanford economist John Taylor, that calculates the rate based on different economic measures, including gross domestic product, and inflation, and the output gaps there. This rule indicates that the Fed left the rate too low for too long during the mid-2000s, contributing to the housing market boom and bust, and has now left it lower than it should be, or should have been, since 2000, with the current calculated rate of around 2%, or a little bit higher. After the previous lessons of failed policies, the Fed will be wise to return a more rules-based approach, which you were getting at, sir, that misallocates fewer resources. Supporters of these policies cheer the unemployment rate from 10%, the drop in the unemployment rate from 10% in October 2009 to 5% in the latest report yesterday, March 2016. But this measure misses the larger number of people who have dropped out of the labor force and those who are working part-time but would like a full-time job, which when added to the total unemployed brings the current underutilization rate, known as the U6 rate, to closer to 10%, 9.8%. Collectively, these policies have misdiagnosed the U.S. economy. There's less economic activity with fewer dollars in the private sector due to higher taxes, more government debt, and more dollars flowing to unsustainable projects from excessive monetary easing. It's no wonder the U.S. has dropped in its rankings of economic freedom, and Americans have been left to suffer. Fortunately, the system of federalism provides a laboratory of competition where you have states that can compete with an umbrella of fiscal policies. In search of a more free market model that would reward risk-taking and entrepreneurial activity, recently published a paper looking at, it's called a labor market comparison. It's on our website, texaspolicy.com, which compares economic freedom and labor market measures among the largest states, California, Texas, New York, and Florida, and looks at the U.S. averages during the last 15 years. Ranking third in economic freedom, according to the Economic Freedom North America, and having the best labor market results compared with these largest states, Texas acts as a model. This high ranking isn't an accident, as Texas has kept tax rates low, never passed a personal income tax, and continues to have sensible regulations. These factors combine to find what's been known as the Texas model. This model helped support the creation of 73% of all new non-farm jobs in the U.S. from January 2000 to December 2014. Although critics often shrug off these as low-paying jobs, the inflation-adjusted private pay has been 67% higher in the state compared compared with the U.S. average during that period, with many more jobs added in high-wage sectors and high-wage jobs than in low-wage jobs, compared with the rest of the U.S. and across Texas. The progressive policy prescriptions in D.C. And in places like California continue to fail, especially regarding energy policy, which I've been asked to discuss some here today. These failures include the overbearing EPA, the lack of approval regarding the Keystone XL pipeline, funding for uneconomical forms of energy, and the overall war by progressives on fossil fuels. Continuing down this path is one that will make Americans poorer, less productive, and more dependent on the government, which could be part of the progressive plan, if you think about it, winning votes, right? To renew the American dream, presidential candidates should consider similar free market measures taken by some states, particularly those in Texas. By providing inclusive institutions that allow free markets to work and support prosperity rather than extractive ones that redistribute resources and hinder progress, the American dream that's alive and well in Texas and in other states can be available for Americans nationwide. The world's energy landscape has radically changed in the last decade because of surging production of oil and natural gas in the U.S. Unimaginable not too long ago, the U.S. is now the world's largest producer of petroleum and petroleum-related liquid fuels. More than three-fourths of the increased global oil production in the last decade is from domestic oil fields, contributing to a drop in our oil imports by roughly 60% since 2007. This sea change, the achievement of a mix of innovative technologies, known collectively as hydraulic fracturing, applied by small and independent oil companies in multiple states. The shale revolution has been so successful that it's produced a large surplus of crude oil. The Energy Information Administration forecasts there could be as much as 3.2 billion barrels of global oil inventory by the end of 2016. There's been so much oil produced in the U.S. that there are barrels of oil that are just sitting in tankers in the Gulf of Mexico now and in rail cars waiting for the day until it's going to be more profitable to sell that oil. For our country to benefit from the colossal energy wealth now at our fingertips, the end of the antiquated 40-year-old export ban that started in January is a step in the right direction. Tankers have now exported oil to other countries at initially slow pace, but this is likely to pick up as oil contracts run out with other countries for other countries, and other countries find in their best interest to purchase crude at a discounted price based on the West Texas Intermediate crude oil price compared to the Brent crude oil price. Although this step provides a positive path in the energy arena regarding a source of energy that is portable, dependable, and affordable, there's much more to do. Unfortunately, the Obama administration and many states have taken it upon themselves to make it more difficult to produce fossil fuels as renewables are propped up as a savior. This approach, if taken to its logical conclusion, will fail as it has in Europe. We must rethink how we produce energy, including how we can better allow free markets to allocate resources most efficiently, rather than the current path of government manipulation without complete knowledge. This path towards greater dependence on free markets is one that will provide a brighter and more prosperous future. So the abundance of this energy, especially with fossil fuels, has transformed the world, particularly since the Industrial Revolution, helping bring more people out of poverty faster than any time in recorded history. Where economics is the study of human action and interaction, whereby scarce resources are used to satisfy individual desires, entrepreneurs are a vital part of this process in satisfying our desires, as their ingenuity transforms markets into something very few thought possible. The shale boom is a terrific story of the economic success. Entrepreneurs helped create an economic environment conducive for the shale boom to bless us with abundant, affordable, and portable fossil fuels that provide efficient energy to satisfy our desires on a daily basis. Even still, with many of the cutting-edge fracking processes coming to fruition in the early 1980s, the price of oil plummeted during that decade, making it not profitable to use these techniques at the time because of expensive drilling techniques. Things began to change during the 2000s. Not only did the techniques become economical as entrepreneurs continued to work to bring down the cost of fracking, but also the price of oil and natural gas were such that it was profitable to frack. The steady climb of oil during the 2000s, particularly in late 2007 and 2008, when the price of WTI hovered around $140 per barrel, there was plenty of profit motive using these more expensive fracking methods. Natural gas production, that includes gross withdrawals and production, took off around that time, with production increasing by 31% from January 2008 to August 2015. Natural gas production was really the first round of this shale boom. That didn't quite transfer early on to the oil production, as the price of oil plummeted during the Great Recession to a low of $35 per barrel in early 2009. It wasn't until the Arab Spring in early 2011 when oil prices recovered, were topping $90 per barrel, and then reaching above $100 per barrel in March 2011. Since then, until the latest EIA data, Information Administration, in December 2015, oil production per day is up 65% to 9.3 million barrels, which remains near the record high in the late 1970 of 10 million barrels per day, and the latest high of 9.6 million barrels per day in April 2015. This is in spite of a substantial 60% drop in the price of oil, showing the high level of efficiencies that are among those oil rigs that are currently online. Texas has been a major contributor to this shale boom. Oil production per day in Texas is up 150% to 3.3 million barrels per day since March 2011 to December 2015, contributing to 55% of the increase in U.S. oil production during this period. It's important to note that this drilling activity has been a bright spot in otherwise dismal economic recovery. The U.S. labor force participation rate remains near lows not seen since the 1970s, but let's somehow cheer this 5% unemployment rate that we have today. The push to end production of fossil fuels by the Obama administration and the overreaching EPA rules and regulations on the coal industry is a push to end much of the prosperity that's been created during the last decade and much longer than that. If you consider what's been going on, consider the total civilian employment since the Great Recession started in December 2007. Texas has added 1.6 million new jobs, while the rest of the U.S. has added 3.2 million. In other words, Texas has created 37% of all new civilian jobs in the last 8+ years. The rest of the U.S. didn't even turn positive since the start of the recession until January 2015, and didn't surpass Texas until November of this year, of last year. Of course, this has not all been oil and gas jobs, which is commonly what's heard by people like Paul Krugman in Texas. Texas is a highly diversified economy with less than 3% of the labor force employed directly by oil and gas, and less than 15% of the real economy based on oil and gas. So what's the solution of a more prosperous nation is to facilitate the ingenuity of entrepreneurs. So there's seven proposals that should have careful consideration as we move forward, along with allowing for more export of oils, allowing for oil exports starting in January. Allowing drilling on federal lands is one. During the last 7 years, more than 90% of all drilling has been on private lands. This has missed out on drilling in areas where there are estimated at least tens of billions of recoverable oil. This could also be combined with selling federal lands and allocating those dollars to pay down the deficit or lowering taxes. I mean, there are other more productive means. Number two, permitting projects like the Keystone XL pipeline and many others that would benefit to allow for a more robust national network of pipelines. Although Americans on different sides of the aisle don't agree on much, a recent Pew Research poll finds that they do agree by a 2-to-1 margin that the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline's northern leg should be built. Allow more refineries to be built in the U.S. is number three. A major new refinery hasn't opened in the U.S. in almost 40 years, while the population and energy production have doubled. Number four, the EPA's overreach should be dissolved such that states have an opportunity to do what works best for them. The EPA has an agenda to put the coal industry out of business and to destroy the natural gas and oil industries, as well as they are succeeding in many ways to do this. Number five, build more nuclear power plants and allow more micronuclear to be used for energy production. If we want to truly reduce the amount of carbon, which is essential for life, this would seem like an optimal path. Number six, end renewable energy standards across states. Number seven, end all subsidies for energy, whether it's renewable or otherwise. So by following these solutions and others that allow free markets to lead the way instead of governments, the American dream can once again seem not so far out of reach for Americans. This will also help to improve the federal government's fiscal problem, as we're discussing fiscal solvency here today, as we spend less on wasteful projects and regulations. Finally, I'd like to call your attention to a new book being released on May 23rd. It's called Fueling Freedom, Exposing the Mad War on Energy. That's co-authored by Steve Moore, the Heritage Foundation, and my colleague, Kathleen White, at the Texas Public Policy Foundation. It'll include the history of how fossil fuels have been a key contributor to economic prosperity and provides more information about these policy proposals and more. So thank you for the time, and I look forward to answering any questions in Q&A.